From Cafe. Welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
How are you, Ann?
I'm good. How you doing?
How was your weekend?
It was great. Too short.
This is usual length.
I know.
It's the same. We're laughing because I don't know. We're late taping because we were giggling a bunch.
Goofing around.
I don't know why. Yeah. There's not a lot to laugh at. Although I will say that we had a special weekend, my family. My dad turned 80.
I saw that you went to the Yankees game.
We went to game two of the playoffs.
That's amazing.
The Yankees won.
It's awesome.
He was very happy.
So is your dad a lifelong Yankees fan?
When we were kids, in the 70s, we were growing up in Jersey, and the Yankees were very hot.
Yeah.
Back then.
You got to be Yankees, Mets, or some people are Phillies.
Yeah, I don't know about those people.
Yeah.
A certain part of Jersey would be Phillies.
Yeah.
So a great time was had by all. And
happy birthday to your dad.
Thank you. He'll appreciate that. You met my dad.
I love your dad.
So a lot of stuff again, as impeachment heats up. We have been talking about the first whistleblower.
Yes.
Whose identity is not yet known.
Yes.
And who I think the president wants to execute, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does he still feel that way? I think he does.
It's so hard to square that with this is how we used to treat people. He's basically a spy, and this is how we used to treat people guilty of treason, which is execution, with the, of course it's legitimate to do this, and China, please help, and everybody should be investigating Biden.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with my call was perfect.
So we appear to have more whistleblowers.
Right.
How many do we have?
So I was going to ask you that. So the...
I asked you that.
You asked me first.
You can't ask me.
Okay. So the lawyer comes out this weekend, and the lawyer who represents whistleblower number one tweets out, I'm going to confirm that we represent another whistleblower. And it looks like that whistleblower, and just to be clear, the definition at this point is someone who, the second whistleblower is someone who was interviewed by the intelligence community inspector general, Michael Atkinson, as part of the investigation into the first whistleblower's complaint. So the first whistleblower files this complaint. Atkinson, in his role to figure out whether or not it's credible, conducts an investigation. And as you or I would do, he interviews witnesses. He probably also gathers documents. This individual, who is reported to have firsthand information about some of the materials contained in whistleblower one's complaint, which is important because some of it is firsthand, but the call, for example, was secondhand. I've been informed that the president had a call with Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. And so this individual, the whistleblower two, the second one, has been interviewed by the inspector general, should be entitled to protections under the law as a whistleblower, has not yet made a formal complaint to Congress. And so—
Not necessary.
Exactly.
Right? My understanding is one does not have to file a formal complaint. You can give testimony, give information, corroborate the allegations made by the first whistleblower.
And it's worth noting just here that Atkinson was before Congress behind closed doors last week, the inspector general of the intelligence community. And it's very clear that they went through a detailed conversation about what he did. And so it's very likely that all the information that was provided to Atkinson has already been provided to the congressional committees, but not in the form of a formal whistleblower complaint.
Yeah. So one question is, how many whistleblowers are there? Because I think one of the lawyers for the main whistleblower that we've all been talking about said that they now represent
a multiple. Right. So then I had to go to the dictionary.
80?
Yeah. So basically, I went to the dictionary because my assumption, I don't know what you think when you hear multiple.
I think more than two.
I think three or four is sort of at least three was my take. I then read the dictionary definition, which makes it clear that more than one is multiple. So two.
This is how careful Ann Milgram is.
I just
you
wanted
take a
know.
Common sense term like multiple.
And make it complicated.
And you're rigorous even about the definition of multiple.
Well, it might.
Would you ever use couple to mean more than two?
Oh.
Hey, it's been a couple of weeks. Do you sometimes
I do that sometimes. I do. It's a good point. So my assumption, and Mark Zaid, he's the attorney who actually represents whistleblower one, confirmed that there's one other whistleblower at least. So I don't know if multiple means more than two. I'm sure there are. If we go back to the initial conversation from the whistleblower, the first whistleblower writes down that he's informed by a number of people in the intelligence community. So the likelihood of there being more than one other person is high.
Right. Well, the universe of people from which there could be a whistleblower is large.
Yes.
Because it's not just the people who were on the call. It's other people who might have heard about the call or got a readout of the call between Trump and Zelensky. It's also people maybe who segregated the call and put it in the special super secret server.
That's right. So it's not clear, but what is clear and is really important, when you do an investigation, it's always very helpful to have multiple people who corroborate the initial allegations. And here you've got the whistleblower coming in, President Trump saying, yes, I did it, a memorandum of the call from July 25th, which also corroborates it. Now you have other people. And what's really important about at least one or more other people coming forward to corroborate and provide information is that there's likely conduct we haven't even heard about yet or that's happened that we don't know of. And so it's sort of, in my mind, it's both potentially corroboration for whistleblower number one and potentially additional information.
But none of it sways Trump ever. So, for example, even though virtually everything that the whistleblower said in the complaint has been borne out by both the readout of the phone call and by other reports.
And the president himself.
The president's own, I mean, he basically confessed. He said, yeah, I said these things. I have a right to care about corruption. We'll get to that statement in a moment. People should look at the Biden situation. Ukraine should look at it. China should look at it. And we'll talk about that also. And yet the president keeps saying that everything the whistleblower said turned out to be false. I don't know how he gets away with saying that.
Well, also, so you and I have done a lot of investigations, and I personally think it's never a great sign for a criminal defendant, and Trump is not a criminal defendant yet, but this is the context through which I see it. It's never a great sign for a criminal defendant when they keep changing their defense. And my head was spinning last week that every day there was another defense. And so first it was the whistleblower is a liar. It's not true. And then it was a combination, you know, sort of the whistleblower credibility, the whistleblower's political, that kind of stuff. Then it was, okay, yes, I had a perfect call. Then it was the sort of, it's all hearsay. It was toggling back and forth. And then
my favorite. You going to get to my favorite?
Yes. At the 11th hour, whose fault is it?
Rick Perry.
That to me was just an incredible moment of, you know, it's like someone, I don't know, let's take a hypothetical. A penguin is stolen out of the Central Park Zoo to use something.
That's your hypothetical?
To use something. People are commuting home from one. No, the Central Park Zoo is going to be mad at me. I use it all the time in my class.
A penguin theft?
No, I use it all the time in my class because sometimes it's hard to deal with like rape, murder and mayhem, and the students get to be a little overloaded by that. But okay, so stay with me on maybe the penguin hypothetical isn't the right one.
No, fine. No, let's go with it.
But something is stolen, and the person who you think is the prime suspect, the first thing they say is, I wasn't there. And then they say, you know, there's evidence that controverts that. And then they say, okay, I was there, but I was nowhere near the penguin tank. There's evidence that controverts that. All right, I was there. I saw somebody else do it. It wasn't me. It was somebody else. Then it becomes, you know, it's this sort of evolution.
It was my penguin.
Yeah, exactly.
It was my penguin. Rick Perry told me to go get the penguin. Did you see, there was a report over the weekend where an anchor on one of the cable news networks wanted to make the point that the president was now blaming Rick Perry, and they had tape. They show tape from Dancing with the Stars, and they accidentally showed Sean Spicer doing his dance. And they were like, no, I'm sorry. That's the wrong Dancing with the Stars former administration official tape. Can we run the right one?
Man, that yellow outfit was too much.
But the fact that there are now so many folks in the Trump administration
who've been on Dancing
with the Stars with big ruffly shirts that they played the wrong one. they had to switch out the tape. And a part of me kind of hopes that the sound engineer did that on purpose, just to make
me
happy.
Don't you think when you go to TV shows, they're so careful about it? Feels like a big mistake. They don't even look alike.
Other than the ruffly shirt.
So the other thing about Rick Perry.
Can you get serious, please?
Is that, yes, I'll get serious and say, has anyone ever been afraid or listened to Rick Perry in their lives? I mean,
they know about the oops.
Maybe.
Right? Remember when he had to name three cabinet agencies that he would eliminate?
Yes.
And you remembered one and two and then oops.
That's right.
I think energy was one of the ones he remembered.
It was. That he now runs. So here's my read. So Trump comes out and says, Rick Perry made me do it. He made me have this call, which is, if I were prosecuting this case, I would be very happy to hear that defense because as they get more and more absurd, they get easier and easier to knock down. And again,
especially when you spend all this time, I mean, as you say, with the penguin kidnapping hypothetical, there are some defenses that are so at odds with each other that they're laughable, and we've done some laughing already. But to say it was a perfect call, it was a beautiful call, which Rick Perry made me do.
Right. It makes no sense.
It makes less sense.
It makes no sense. And juries tend to actually be very unsympathetic when they think people are changing their story. And again, I should say this, having done a lot of cases with victims who don't initially come in truthful or as forthright because they're afraid of a number of things, what usually happens is there's one change where someone says, okay, look, I haven't been telling you the truth. Here's the truth. And then all the truth comes out. This is not an analogous situation. It's not the same thing. But going back to Rick Perry for a second, what also becomes pretty interesting about this, and we shouldn't spend too much time on it, but let's just note that Rick Perry, as the Secretary of Energy, is working on removing the board members from the state-run gas company in Ukraine. And why that's important is that there's allegations, and two of the people who have already been called by the House committee were involved in this activity. There's allegations that they were trying to take out the board member and put in a board member and then get contracts to President Trump and Rick Perry's allies and friends for gas. And so there's an underlying allegation of corruption here. I don't know if it's accurate or not, but it's at least on its face, it appears to be that Perry's motives and his work in Ukraine may have had something to do with getting money and potentially corrupt, right? And at least worth having an inquiry about. So what's a little funny is that Perry's defense now, his spokesperson is saying, oh, yeah. He called he wanted the president to call about his stuff, which I read as his right. corruption, not about the president's investigations, which I read as the potential corruption of the president of the United States. So it's a little bit of a funny defense to be like, oh, no, this is just about getting natural gas contracts and getting a change in natural gas. It's not really about the investigations into 2016 and Biden.
The interesting thing about all this is that on the key issue of the appropriateness of asking Ukraine and then later China to investigate the Bidens, Trump has basically taken the position that that's appropriate, right? That's the latest iteration because you can't get around the fact that he asked them to do this. And Trump says, and this really has eaten at me, even though I should be not surprised at crazy assertions he makes, he said on the White House lawn this weekend, I am only interested in corruption. I don't care about politics, right? As if this man, for the first time, even though there's corruption all around him, there's corruption in all sorts of countries. The one time that he calls for there to be a corruption investigation, in his words, happens when it's the guy who is leading in the polls to oppose him as president in 2020. He was asked on the White House lawn by a good reporter, have you ever called for the investigation of somebody who is not your political opponent? He couldn't.
It's a great question.
He couldn't answer the question. The example I brought up over the weekend, because it's close to my heart, is there was an occasion when Chris Collins, the former Republican representative, former now because he pled guilty to corruption insider trading charges last week. When that case was made, when the arrest was made in that case before the 2018 midterms, President Trump basically said, here's what he said, two long-running Obama-era investigations of two very popular Republican congressmen were brought to a well-publicized charge. Did he care about corruption then? No. He cared about politics. He says they're brought just ahead of the midterms by the Jeff Sessions Justice Department. Two easy wins now in doubt because there is not enough time. Good job, Jeff. You can come up with hundreds of examples
yes.
of where Trump cared about politics, doesn't care about corruption. The thought that he cares about corruption.
Including Paul Manafort.
I mean, there are easy. And Michael Cohen.
Yes.
You know, it's case after case after case. So it really kind of gets to me. And you see on the shows this past weekend that most people do not want to defend the idea that it's appropriate for the president to call upon either Ukraine or China to investigate a political rival. You have you see the Marco Rubio defense?
Yes, the very silly defense of it was a joke. The president didn't really mean it, which is
he's trying to bait the press. No, this is what that could be a Sunday morning show, bait the press. he meant what he said. He didn't just say it on the White House lawn. He said it on other occasions. He put it in a tweet. There's no laugh track here.
Also, the thing about the Rubio and others who basically said he didn't really mean it, right? He has some motivation, whether it's debate the press or, you know, he's being flippant, joking around. It's completely implausible for a variety of reasons, including the fact that he had a call with the president of Ukraine that was completely serious and was related to the same issue. But also, the president is under intense pressure and intense scrutiny. And the idea that he would now be joking around in a way with foreign adversaries and countries that, you know, we're in the middle of a very complex tariff negotiation, trade negotiation with China. China is an authoritarian regime with which we have a complex relationship and is, frankly, a world power and a growing world power. So the idea that there's anything that the president would do that wasn't serious on this is completely fake. And it's a little bit insulting because I think the Republican team members, they're deciding right now, do they stay silent? And in some ways at this point, in my view, silence is complicity because these are very, very important and critical national security and foreign affairs issues. Do they criticize the president, which only a handful of Republicans have done? Or do they do the sort of Marco Rubio, which is try to have it both ways, which is to basically say, oh, it would be terrible. I would never support that. But that's not what's happening here. And it's like, actually, the American public is watching what's happening here. So stop telling us what we're seeing. And just let me say this. And I'd be interested to know what you think. But I think one of the mistakes people have made with Donald Trump is not taking him at his word, particularly before the election when there were allegations of sexism and racism and things he'd said. And people said, oh, it's hyperbolic. He's joking. Well, he doesn't mean it.
When he crosses a line, the best people can say is, well, he didn't really mean it. He's trying to bait the press. But it's interesting to me that there are very, very few people, if any, who will say, is it appropriate for the president to call on a foreign power to investigate a political rival? I saw one exchange with Jim Jordan and I think another one with Senator Ron Johnson. And they can't say it.
They can't say
it. So they have no way around it. Let's go back to
– Can we just stay on that point for 1 second? Do you remember when the president was asked by Stephanopoulos, you know, what would happen if a foreign country got dirt on your political rival? Would you accept it? Now, that is a better situation, like, quote, better, because they've just gone out and gotten dirt on your political rival without you asking them. So there's no sort of sense there that the president has abused his or her power. That scenario was just – the other country has dirt, would you take it? And the president said, yeah, I would look at it. And he was criticized by a large number of Republicans who came forward in that hypothetical and said, no, we shouldn't do it, which is amazing that they're now quiet because that is a less terrible scenario than what we have here.
Clearly what the president thinks is it's okay. And it's politics is politics and there are no lines and there are no limits. And you can do what you want. You can call people up. You can ask them to change data. You can call people up. You can ask them to investigate your opponents. You know, why not? Someone offers you dirt, you take the meeting. It's called politics. He says it all the time. And every once in a while, when he gets chastised by a number of folks and it looks like it's bad for him in the public realm, he'll pull back a little bit. But you know, in his heart of hearts, he thinks these are all appropriate things to do. And who knows on how many other occasions he's done this. So going back to the whistleblowers for a second, are you surprised that more whistleblowers are coming forward, or at least one other whistleblower is coming forward, given the grief and the invective that's been launched against the first whistleblower?
So I think that something feels like it's changed to me, and I don't know where this ends. It feels to me like there's accountability and questioning of the president's actions in a way that we haven't seen in the past couple of years. And so in some ways, I'm surprised, but truthfully, I'm not. I mean, I think in my experience, government employees, and they take a lot of criticism for different things, and particularly at the hands of President Trump, but government employees are generally phenomenal people who take those jobs because they want to serve their country and do the right thing. And I think there has been more fear. The fact that the first whistleblower came forward in some ways, I think, has galvanized people to step forward. And he's the technical whistleblower, but I want to talk about Bill Taylor at the State Department in a minute, because what he's also done, he's a career Foreign Service State Department employee. What he's done is nothing short of extraordinary to push back on what he thought he was seeing was corruption. And so in some ways, I feel like once one person steps out, it's easier for the second and third people. And there's this great TED video where, like, how movements are formed. Have you ever seen it? The guy dancing like crazy. He's at a concert. We should post it on Cafe Insider. He's dancing like
crazy.
Post
the right video. Don't post Sean Spicer
actually,
from Dancing with the Stars.
Please post both. So he's dancing, and he's dancing like this. It's hilarious. And
may the record reflect that in the studio, Anne Milgram began to dance.
In an absurd way. So this guy
That's
is doing
arm,
it.
Good arm movement. Wow.
And it's even more than that.
Sometimes I do wish this was video.
And so there's a guy who studies movements at a university, and he's narrating it and saying, it's not the first person that creates the movement. It's the second person, right? Because it's one person. Once you need a follower, and then you need more followers, and that creates momentum. And I think there's one thing that's really different here than we've seen with the Mueller investigation, which was largely Trump's inner circle and his campaign and a lot of people who'd signed on as Trump loyalists. This is different because you have people in the State Department, you have people in the Office of Management and Budget, you'll have people in the Energy Department. And so it's a lot harder for the president to control in the National Security Council, in the intelligence agencies. It's vastly more reliant upon career government servants who've taken an oath for the country to keep quiet about wrongdoing. And so that's why I think we might see more.
So separate from the whistleblowing situation with the Ukraine call and request to Ukraine, there has been known for some months, based on court documents, there's a whistleblower within the IRS, apparently related to the audit of either the president's tax returns or the vice president's tax returns. That's unfolding. Unclear what's going to happen there. But you might start to see whistleblowing situations in contexts apart from what we already know about.
And what's important is that for the president to control the apparatus of the executive branch, he does go through the different cabinet departments, like the Department of the Treasury, and they oversee taxation. And so there are employees who are touching these highly politicized issues and questions and coming forward. And so I think I agree with you.
So let's talk about Ukraine some more. Why don't we talk about who the players are? Because sometimes you read these articles and they throw out a name and it's hard to sort of keep track. First name I'll mention is Maria Yovanovitch. Did I get that right?
Yes. Well done.
Do you know how to pronounce the name?
I've now seen that she's, well, this is like a trick question. I've now seen that she's often referred to as Masha. That's her nickname.
Let's call her Masha.
Yovanovitch.
So Masha Yovanovitch was the long-term diplomat, career diplomat. I don't know her personally. Gets good reviews as being someone who cared about the interests of the United States. Was the ambassador to Ukraine and was removed as ambassador from Ukraine in the spring, I think in May. Which I think raised some eyebrows at the time. And one of the reasons it's now raising eyebrows further is all the things that ensued after her removal, but also there are reports in the paper over the past couple of days that one of the reasons she was removed is, it's all coming together, Rudy Giuliani was really upset because she was standing in the way of what?
His investigation and his work pushing the Ukrainians to investigate the 2016 election and whether the Ukrainians were helping Hillary Clinton and also the Biden investigation.
So that's just another bit of data.
It's an important piece of data because if it's true that there are a couple of pieces that I thought were really interesting. One is that Trump was personally interested in having her removed, which seems for people who understand the way that the federal government works, for the president of the United States to be worried about a specific ambassador from one country is pretty unusual. I mean, the president usually would sort of defer, or for the president even to know about a specific ambassador seems unusual to me. There are more than 200 countries in the world. The Secretary of State generally deals with it. So that's one piece. The second piece is that the idea that the president's personal lawyer could impact who serves as a government official. And again, you know, all accounts are that she was a very strong ambassador, and we haven't seen allegations that she was removed for wrongdoing. The reporting right now is that she was removed because she wouldn't help the president's personal lawyer do the president's personal bidding. And so it's a really important tie to the use of the State Department and the federal government resources for the president's personal political gain.
It also raises questions once again about Rudy Giuliani. By the way, I'm starting to tire of people, no offense, of people calling him president's personal lawyer because, and I do it all the time.
Yeah, he's really not. I agree. You
know, he's the president's agent in some way. But in all of this business with complaining about this ambassador, I don't understand the legal issue on which he was providing representation or advice or guidance to the president. It's not legal work just because you once upon a time had a law degree and honored the precepts of being a lawyer.
You're
in,
right.
In New York.
Let's say it differently. Rudy Giuliani is a lawyer, and he does work for the president, right? It's like we're connecting the two.
But it's also significant, not just rhetorically, but it will be significant with respect to what he will have to answer about.
Correct.
And what privileges he will be able to maintain. So Yovanovitch is out of there. Then you have a guy who you've already mentioned, Bill Taylor, who was once upon a time in the second Bush administration ambassador to Ukraine, so he knows it well. Another career diplomat, military veteran, who some people have described as the hero in all of this because he clearly seems to have been making a record with respect to the president's requests on these things.
I was wondering if we should have a heroes and villains section of each podcast. I mean, the president can't win the villain every time.
I think it's lopsided at the moment.
Only other thing to say about Taylor is that he was brought back after Yovanovitch was fired. He was brought back this past summer as the charge d'affaires, like the person in Kiev.
He's basically the interim.
Yes, he's the interim acting ambassador.
Then you got a guy, Kurt Volker, who testified before the House last week,
he recently resigned. Until then, he was the U.S. special representative to Ukraine, and he resigned as the scandal unfolded and testified before Congress last week. And it looks like he's sort of one of the senior people specifically on Ukraine.
And then you have Gordon Sondland.
Yes.
Who I don't know and never heard of before.
And by the way, can I just say about Volker, he was a career diplomat.
Yeah.
He left and was heading, I think, the McCain Institute and then came back in sort of a hybrid.
Resigned from that too.
Resigned from that as well. But he is a career State Department official.
So then you have Gordon Sondland, who I did not know and I'd not heard of before, who is the ambassador to the European Union, not a career diplomat, never been in the State Department before, runs hotel businesses, sounds familiar. At one point, didn't like Donald Trump.
Right.
And said he couldn't support Donald Trump, changed his mind after the election, apparently, gave $1 million to the inaugural committee.
Yes.
And on the strength of being a donor, presumably, all of a sudden was launched into this brief diplomatic career as the ambassador to the European Union. By the way, important fact, Ukraine is not in the European Union.
Right. That's right.
So they're all having lots of conversations along with and meetings along with Rudy Giuliani in connection with what the president wants from Ukraine.
Right. And with what Ukraine wants from the United States as well. And it's worth talking a little bit about how important it was, and I think this is missing from some of the reporting now, how important it was for Ukraine. President Zelensky is elected, you know, I think last April 2019, and comes into office and basically wants the U.S. support. And he wants U.S. support because Russia has annexed Crimea, a portion of Ukraine, and Russia still controls a portion of Crimea. Russia has an interest, clearly, in potentially annexing more of Ukraine and also minimizing the ability of Ukraine to be part of the European Union, to work with NATO, to basically have this sort of independent power base. And so there is a lot of continued conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And so what Ukraine wants is the support of the president of the United States. And U.S. policy has been very supportive of Ukraine for almost 30 years. You know, the annexation took place under right. Obama and was very angry about it. And so what is important to understand in the behind the scenes of these text messages that went back and forth is that all of the U.S. government officials wanted the United States government both to provide, I don't know about Sondland, but I can say from having read the Volker and Taylor texts that they definitely wanted the president to provide the military, the almost $400 million in support, and they want a sit-down meeting at the White House because that is what the Ukrainians want to basically say to Russia, the U.S. has our back, don't interfere with us, don't invade us. And so there's a lot of sort of the State Department symbolism of how important it is to have the U.S. and Ukraine connecting on this.
So I want to repeat again that whether or not there's a quid pro quo, in my mind, I think the minds of a lot of people, yourself included, the mere fact that the President of the United States makes a request of a foreign power directly in a phone call to investigate by name a political rival is an abuse of power, potentially an impeachable offense, period.
Agreed.
And I also said, and I think maybe you agreed with me, that you never see written evidence of a quid pro quo.
Yeah,
and,
never.
And then I had to write this weekend, I stand corrected.
Yes.
Because here you sort of, you have that. You don't need it. It's enough without it. And I remember some Democrats were talking about quid pro quo and you can expect to see it. Then the Republicans began to say, well, you know, we have the complaint, and one version of a defense was, see, there's no explicit quid pro quo.
In the complaint.
It's fallen flat. Now, they can't say that anymore. And you have a back and forth about the things that Ukraine wanted, as you mentioned, as simple as a White House meeting, which is very important to them, and obviously something that's a little bit more substantial, like this hundreds of millions of dollars in aid. And so all these conversations are going on.
And this is important also, because you and I have talked about this before, but it was made clear both in the whistleblower complaint and in some other things that have been reported that the Ukrainians knew that the aid, were upset that the aid hadn't been given over. It was months that they were waiting, and that they had been told that the condition for a call between the president and Zelensky, just the call, was that they were going to talk about the Biden investigations. And so it's been this really interesting question of what was happening behind the scenes. Now we have a number of text messages which still don't tell us the full picture, but do provide a lot of information. And as you said, a quid pro quo.
And further to what you were saying a second ago, we have in the correspondence a text message from a Ukrainian official who shared a report back in the end of August, August 28th, saying, Trump holds up Ukraine military aid meant to confront Russia. And he sends that to Ambassador Volker. Kurt Volker, who we've been talking about. And clearly, there have been other conversations that are not recorded or that we haven't gotten to the bottom of. And we should also note that this is a subset of the texts that are in the possession of the Intelligence Committee and there are many, many other texts. And some people have accused Adam Schiff of cherry picking. We'll have to see what the rest of the texts show. But as far as we know now, Bill Taylor on September 1st sends a text to the European Union Ambassador Gordon Sondland, the hotelier. Quote, are we now saying that security assistance and White House meeting are conditioned on investigations? That, by the way, if that's true, and it looks like he thinks that that is true, that sentence contains every element of a quid pro quo.
Yes.
Including the pro, which we seldom see, which is represented by the word conditioned on.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then what does Gordon Sondland reply?
Call me.
Call me.
Because he doesn't want it on the record.
He doesn't want it. You know what that reminds me of?
What?
I think you and I have talked about this on occasion. Sometimes somebody will come across your desk and you're trying to hire someone, and maybe it's somebody who used to work with me or that you think I might know or I think you might know, and it happens often, right? Because over the course of your life, you hire lots of folks. And I will send a text message to you, for example, and say like, hey, do you know so-and-so? And if they're wonderful, you immediately text back.
They're the greatest.
They're great. They're smart. They're hardworking. If you want to know more, happy to talk.
Yes.
On every occasion where I've written a text message or an email to someone and said, hey, do you know so-and-so, thinking about hiring that person? And the person responds with, call me.
Yes.
It's never positive.
It never ends well. Exactly.
Right. They don't want to put the negative impression about that person. And that's exactly what's going on here, isn't it?
Yes. And it's also very clear that I think Sondland realizes at some point, I'm being papered, which people do all the time in government and frankly outside of government too. But what it is Taylor's going on the record saying, is this what you're telling me? This is what we're doing, that we are conditioning this meeting on helping an investigation. And Taylor, there's another one too that I think is really incredibly powerful that Taylor writes, and this is September 9th.
Let's go to September 8th first.
September 8th.
Yeah, look, these conversations clearly are going on for some days. The aide is held in abeyance. The meeting is held in abeyance. And Bill Taylor writes a text, which I think is to Kurt Volker. The nightmare is they give the interview and don't get the security assistance. The Russians love it. And then he writes in parens, I quit.
Yes.
So it again, it looks like there's a something for something and the security assistance is being held in abeyance. And then ultimately, he's suggesting that maybe the Trump administration looks like it's bluffing and doesn't want to give the security assistance because of this other dimension of appeasing the Russians.
Right. And that is the subtext of all this. And one of the interesting questions, I think, before these messages was, is Trump just trying to help the Russians or is this actually about the quid pro quo for the investigations into 2016 and the Biden family? One thing I also think that is important to note is that Sondland and Volker, they're trying to get the Ukrainians to issue this generic statement saying that they're committed to fighting corruption and they're going to do investigations into corruption. They're trying to smooth it over. So
it doesn't look so obvious.
Exactly. And they're also trying to get to a point where the Ukrainians get the money. They're worried about they're not getting the money. So they're actually trying to help Ukraine, but they're doing it in a way to say, well, we're not going to commit the Ukrainians to doing specific investigations, but what if we just say they're open to doing political corruption investigations? The president of Ukraine won't sign it. And he won't sign it because he doesn't want to be involved in the U.S. political election or be committed in any way to doing these investigations of Biden and this 2016 thing. And so that is a huge red flag for anyone who works in government that the president of the foreign country is like, no, this is a corrupt deal. I'm not taking it. And Ukraine needs us so much that for him to do that is really important.
We should just make clear to everyone, there's all this stuff that gets confusing, right? Because the president does have certain powers and authorities. And just because he asserts an authority doesn't mean that it's a proper usage. And it doesn't mean it's not an abuse of power in the same way that other kinds of bargains happen all the time. And all of politics and much of diplomacy is about, in the informal sense, quid pro quo. We say to a country, there's nothing wrong with saying to a country, we're not going to give you your aid. We're going to hold up your aid until you deal with a humanitarian crisis in your country, or unless you come to the table on trade, or some other thing that's in the national interest of America.
Including, by the way, political corruption.
Absolutely. We do it all the time. You should do it.
That's not specific, right.
But if it turns out that the thing that you're saying America will or will not do for you, taxpayer money, in exchange for something that is of personal benefit to me, like, for example, I'm not saying this happened here, I want to make sure that all your delegations, when they come to the United States, stay at a Trump property, or I want you to investigate my political rival. If the exchange is in connection with something for the benefit of the President of the United States, that's an abuse of power. So when people throw out these quid pro quo, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with caring about corruption. There's nothing wrong with asking a country to do X, Y, or Z. The nub of it is, was part of it or much of it about personal gain to the president of the United States. That's an abuse of, that's not how we want our president to be engaging in foreign policy. And I think it's eminently impeachable if it's true.
That's a great point. It's also, it also explains why the president's, one of his defenses, one of his many defenses has been, look, I just want to stop corruption. Because
nobody believes that, but he still says it.
Yes.
And then we get to this, I think, the most incriminating text. And again, look, there are people, I've seen this in life too. They try to paper something and they exaggerate. And maybe they wrongly think something is inappropriate. Doesn't look like that's the case with Bill Taylor, but that does sometimes happen in the world. You have an employee at an organization, thinks bad things are going on, and they write texts to CYA.
Yeah, I don't think this is just CYA.
I don't think so either.
I think he's also trying to say to Sondland, and Bill Taylor has been a well-respected Foreign Service officer for many years. He's trying to say to Sondland, he's like screaming, this isn't right. You know, he's sort of saying like, this is a problem, we got to fix it.
And he's letting him know, I'm papering you, so you know. And then I'm excited to have you read Sondland's response. Because the back and forth that we've seen so far is pretty casual. It's pretty short, quick texts back and forth. Bill Taylor writes once again, basically setting up the existence of the quid pro quo. And he says to Sondland, as I said on the phone, meaning there's a whole conversation that he's trying to memorialize now in a way. As I said on the phone, I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance, right? That's one thing. For help with a political campaign. So he viewed the thing as help with a political campaign, and he also viewed the things as being conditioned on the other. By the way, we don't know if Bill Taylor has contemporaneous notes of the phone call. There might be a lot more evidence of all this stuff.
I agree completely. I suspect there is because he's a career Foreign Service officer. He's probably jotting notes down and then hangs up and immediately sends a text message.
And then Sondland, many hours go by. And I don't know if this was because he was sleeping and who was in what country at the time these texts were sent. But Sondland takes some time and in the interim, I think, had a conversation with people around Trump.
Someone, agreed.
And Gordon Sondland replies,
Bill, I believe you are incorrect about President Trump's intentions. The president has been crystal clear, no quid pro quos of any kind. The president is trying to evaluate whether Ukraine is truly going to adopt the transparency and reforms that President Zelensky promised during his campaign. I suggest we stop the back and forth by text. If you still have concerns, I recommend you give Lisa Kenna or Essa a call to discuss them directly. Thanks.
That's very carefully worded.
Very. And it's interesting he says quid pro quo because it's very clear that he knows exactly what Taylor has done, which is to connect the two things that the president wants them to connect, but Sondland and everyone else want to pretend is not connected.
So here's my question to Sondland. You write, Mr. Sondland, the president has been crystal clear, no quid pro quos of any kind. What is the basis and the evidence to support that the president has been crystal clear on no quid pro quo? You can have an argument, and we're going to have that argument, maybe during impeachment proceedings or otherwise, that what the president said doesn't quite amount to a quid pro quo. And as I said, I don't think it matters, but it's extra evidence and makes it extra bad. But there is nothing to suggest he ever said, ever, I want to make sure that you separate these things. They're not connected to each other. It's not appropriate. No quid pro quo. Nothing. I mean, I'd be shocked if there's any support of that, which then allows you to view this entire response from Sondland to Taylor as his own CYA.
Yes, as papering that, oh, I'm going to tell you now. And also, I want you to get in line a little bit to Taylor of the, you know, you can talk to somebody else if you have concerns, but I'm shutting this down now. I'm telling you there's nothing wrong with what we're doing. And Sondland is clearly, he does take time to respond. We need to know who he talked to in between. And we also need to see all his notes and all the conversations he's had about those investigations. So it appears to me it's not going to end well for Sondland as part of this congressional investigation because you have a career Foreign Service officer telling a political appointee, we're doing something wrong. And the political appointee saying, oh, no, it's not wrong because there's no direct leverage of one for the other.
Further to what you were saying before, and again, I don't know Bill Taylor and his credibility will be tested in proceedings that are coming up. But it is notable that there's a former U.S. official, anonymous but still significant, quoted in Politico as saying about Bill Taylor, he's the only honorable man in this disgusting drama. So he was trying to do something. I think it makes it, you know, the release of these texts makes it really, really hard for this to go away, number one. And then number two, it will lead to further testimony, perhaps further corroboration, because there may be further emails and texts and contemporaneous notes, as we've said. And you have a compelling figure who, based on their history and their resumes, Bill Taylor seems to be more credible in connection with these kinds of issues than Mr. Sondland.
Yes. And so Taylor's also the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And so one other thing that I suspect and I would like to know is Masha Yovanovitch is pushed out in May of 2019 as the ambassador to Ukraine. Taylor is brought in as the sort of interim person. He knows the country. It's meant to stabilize probably what's happening. It would surprise me if he and she have not had a number of conversations about what was happening and what Giuliani was doing. And so Taylor's going to be interesting for a lot of reasons, but he's going to probably also corroborate, I suspect, a lot that Masha Yovanovitch has to say.
So Mike Pompeo has finally admitted that he listened in on the call. And what's interesting about that, further to what we were saying before, it's not so much that he was on the call, although maybe it's interesting. I don't know enough about diplomacy to understand how significant it is for him to be on that kind of call. But he didn't come out and say it. If it was such a perfect and beautiful call, why not right away say, yeah, the president's totally right. I was on that call and it was beautiful and perfect, even though Rick Perry made him do it.
It feels like he was playing, doesn't it feel a little like they were all playing this game that the call might not come out up until the point that the president put it out? And then even after that,
I think he advocated against it, right?
That's
one reason Pompeo would have advocated against it. Because he sees what Taylor saw and what normal people see.
Yes. And so he then, and he gave these answers that I think were misleading at best about, I haven't read the complaint yet. You just handed me the complaint to one of the reporters, the whistleblower complaint. I haven't had a chance to review it. When in fact, he didn't need to really review it to talk about the call because he was on it. The other thing to think about with Pompeo is he subscribes to the president's school of thought, which is a good offense is the best defense. And so he immediately comes out swinging when State Department employees get calls and requests for information because the House committees, there are three committees now conducting this impeachment inquiry, and they want information from all these State Department officials, as you would. And so they're asking for information. They're contacting witnesses, potential witnesses. And so Pompeo fires back and says, you're harassing my employees, none of which is true. But again, it's sort of playing offense to say, what's happening isn't fair, I'm the victim, and this needs to end, when it feels to me the exact opposite is the case, which if I were doing the investigation, the first people I would look to talk to would be all the men and women in the State Department who've been involved with Ukraine in any way connected to this incident.
So then we have Mike Pence.
Yes.
Who is an interesting figure in all this. And, you know, over the course of the Trump presidency, I've gotten the distinct impression that he is never to be seen when bad stuff is happening.
Yeah.
He kind of, until now. And he's thrown in his, what's the word? Not the towel. What do you throw in? He's thrown in with.
Yes.
He's cast
his
lot.
He's
all in. The towel is a different thing.
Against the do-nothing Democrats, as he and the president call them.
Yeah. And, you know, there's now, I think people need to remain focused. I've seen some people talk about beginning an impeachment proceeding against Mike Pence. Look, one thing at a time, ladies and gentlemen. Somebody I saw even suggested impeach Mike Pence first, and then I don't know what people are talking about. Focus on the president. Focus on the involvement of the president.
Yeah, it's worth noting, Pence is a witness, and he's being called as a witness to what the president was doing and what the administration was doing. He had a meeting with Ukrainian President Zelensky, and he got a readout of the call the following day. And so the inquiry from Congress is, what did you know? Did you ever talk to Zelensky about these investigations? What did you know? What was the 2016 in the Biden family? What do you know about this? And so at this point, he's not accused of wrongdoing so much as he didn't stop wrongdoing potentially from happening, and he's a witness to it. And so, again, I agree with you. I think he's stayed away from, by and large, the controversies and the things that the president has done. He is squarely in the middle of this one.
And the president threw him into the mix. I think at one point, in front of cameras, talking about his own beautiful and perfect phone call with Zelensky, said, you know, the vice president, Pence, had a call, too. You should look at his call,
I'm sure
the vice president didn't love very much.
Let's just talk for a second, since we're here, about the White House subpoenas and the Pence request for documents. So Preet, while we're talking about this, let's just talk for a couple minutes about the fact that the White House has now gotten a subpoena that's due back October 19th, and it's basically asking for all the information materials related to this call and to the withholding of funds from Ukraine, everything to do with Ukraine.
That's on top of the subpoenas we talked about last week to Rudy Giuliani and others.
So, and Mike Pompeo.
So there's a lot of information being sought.
And there's a request for information of Vice President Pence. It's not a subpoena yet. And the reason that Pence has gotten a request for information and not a subpoena is that the White House had previously received a request for information. They've refused to provide it. They've indicated that they're not going to be cooperative with Congress. And so Congress has basically said, you've given us no choice but to paper you. And now the White House has to decide, do they respond to the subpoena? Do they go to court to quash the subpoena? What comes next?
So some of the people from whom information has been requested and testimony has been sought are the names we've been talking about. Kurt Volker has already come in. We've seen his opening statement. We haven't seen the testimony yet. Masha Maria Yovanovitch.
She's scheduled to come in on the 11th. Yes.
Ambassador Gordon Sondland.
Sondland has been requested to come in. He's been requested to be deposed by Congress. He has not confirmed or scheduled that yet.
And then a whole other bunch of folks. Now, what's going on with Bill Taylor?
So it's just worth noting that there are a lot of other people that the committees have requested documents from and depositions from. They've asked to depose Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent, one of the counselors, Ulrich Brechbol, also not scheduled. Then a couple of Giuliani associates, the folks that I was mentioning, were also related to this natural gas issue. They've been requested to be deposed, Lev Parnas, Igor Fruman. And then there are other Giuli associates, including someone named Semyon Kislin, who's been requested. And so there's a lot, I think, that's going to come. And one question for you, Preet, is how do you feel about the way that you and I are often critics of congressional investigations and questioning? Like, how do you feel like it's being conducted so far?
So I think pretty thoroughly. And I think they have a good beat on what's going on. And they have a certain momentum, which I think is required for these kinds of investigations. The problem and the criticism that we sometimes cite is the inefficiency and inefficacy of having for the first time a witness come before a congressional committee and everyone gets 5 minutes. And we've often talked about how it might be better if you get a professional lawyer to ask those questions. But what's even better than that is what they're doing in this case. And that is, in the first instance, you have professional staff behind closed doors take lengthy depositions. The U.S. attorney firing investigation that I helped to lead back in 2007 was exactly that. No one ever saw me ask a question at a hearing. But I took hours and hours of depositions along with some of my colleagues on both the Democratic and Republican side. I mean, once we did a deposition for 10 hours of the then Attorney General's chief of staff. And then that information, because you get to explore everything, the person can't filibuster, you can go and ask the same question 20 times. You don't have to worry that the clock is ticking. You went all day. And then you take that information, you give it to the members who are actually elected by the public. And then when they have their public hearing following the behind the closed doors depositions, they can be more focused. They can impeach the witness, to use that term, based on things that they said in the deposition if they're changing their mind publicly. And it's just a much more efficient, much more thorough way of doing it.
Yeah, it seems to be excellent. And I would say the behind closed doors piece also takes a lot of the political grandstanding out of it at this point. And so there's a huge amount of momentum and I think effectiveness that they'll get for this investigation by doing it the way they're doing it.
Now, do you think this is all going to be wrapped up by Thanksgiving or the end of the year? Because that seems to be some people's speculation. Now, you know, you and I as litigators know when you throw out this many requests for information and think about how many fights there will be about subsets of this and whether or not they can proceed without getting some of this, because some of the court battles might be lengthy, what are the odds this is going to wrap up soon? Doesn't look like it.
That's a great question. I think they should keep the end of the year as their deadline. I don't think Thanksgiving is remotely possible for the reasons you just said, which is that there are individuals who they will want to hear from who, or at least depose, whether or not they call them before the committee, but they will want people on record. It's critical when you do these investigations not to have folks out there that you believe have important information who have not provided that information to you. And so I think that litigation could take a period of time. Also, here's the other thing I think. We're just talking about State Department employees right now. We haven't gotten to the OMB people who didn't release the money that Congress had appropriated.
Office of Management and Budget.
Yes.
Right.
And so there are a lot. We haven't gotten to the other intelligence employees potentially.
Who were putting the phone calls, specific phone calls, in the special server.
So there are a lot of people, and I agree with you, I would do depositions of everyone at this moment in time, and that is going to require a huge amount of time and effort, and then you've got to think about committee hearings and process. So I think they should push to get it done by the end of the year. I think it's really important for the American public, but I think it's hard.
One thing they have laid the groundwork for, even if they don't get all the information, is the assertion that they will draw adverse inferences.
Yes.
If there is no information handed over, and also they might also view that as obstruction itself, and it might be, standalone articles of impeachment based on that with refusal to give information over.
I think that's right. And I think there are individuals for whom they will make a decision that they're not going to litigate for 6 months or a year to get the information. But I also do think that there may be individuals that they're going to push to get in part because if they vote articles of impeachment and it goes to trial, you and I both know, you want to know what all the witnesses are going to say before the matter goes to trial.
Yes.
And to the extent that they have the ability and courts will enforce the Congress's ability to have witnesses speak to them, which I believe they have, you want those people to have to go on record in some form before they stand up at a trial in the United States Senate and start saying,
yeah,
oh, here's what I think, or here's what I did.
It'll be interesting when we get further along. We can talk about what the procedures in the Senate would be for a trial. And as far as I know right now, that's kind of up to Mitch McConnell. And it could be, you know, a quick cursory affair, or it could be long and detailed with process for both sides. But you're exactly right. It should not be the case, if you want to have a fair outcome, that the president withholds witnesses from coming forward and then at trial in the Senate—
Gets to bring them out. Yes.
Because that doesn't seem to be fair. So by the way, the other thing is that we mostly talk just about Ukraine.
There's a lot happening.
There's also China.
Right.
And the president stands on the front lawn and says, I think that the Biden should be investigated over China. We're running a little short on time, so we can't go through all the details. But that's another country where just because you're making the request publicly doesn't mean it's not inappropriate. And I've seen very few people, as we discussed already, defending it other than to say, well, the president really didn't mean it.
Right. And the allegation I think the president is making there is that Hunter Biden was part of a fund that was raising money. And there's reporting that Hunter Biden and some others talked with Chinese private equity investors about joining together to create a fund that would invest Chinese capital and potentially other capital from other countries outside of China. And so I think that Biden was eventually an investor in the fund. He wasn't initially, and then he later had some investment in the fund. There's no allegation of wrongdoing. I think the allegation potentially would be that Biden was profiting because he worked with the Chinese individuals, and that in some way being related to the former vice president was meaningful. He didn't actually invest till after Biden was no longer vice president. It was 2017. Again, it feels just like smoke and mirrors.
And the amount of money, the $1.5 billion is this big number that gets thrown around.
It looks like
it comes from one source.
Yeah, it looks like $420,000.
Yeah. By the way, the president also.
But again, I don't want to say in any way. By giving that information, I just want people who listen to us to know what's happening and why the president is standing there saying that China needs to investigate. There's zero allegations that have been supported of wrongdoing. And so it's just important to know that, right, at this point, it's just, you know, it's like the president is just basically throwing out things, hoping that they'll stick.
Yeah.
And this is
an
example.
And he's got one critic who he's gone after, who I welcome him to the fold of folks who are calling out the president, former presidential candidate Mitt Romney, who tweeted, quote, "When the only American citizen President Trump singles out for China's investigation is his political opponent in the midst of the Democratic nomination process, it strains credulity to suggest that it is anything other than politically motivated." And then he says what the president has done here, his appeal to China and to Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden, is wrong and appalling. How'd the president take that?
Not well. It's funny. The president actually lashed out more against Romney than most other folks.
Than against Putin?
Yeah. MBS, Mohammed bin Salman. Yes, it's really interesting. So Trump writes back, "Mitt, get off the stage. You've had your turn," parentheses, twice. And he then, in response to a tweet that says, "Question of the afternoon, has hashtag Mitt Romney become the new hashtag Jeff Flake, or is the latest back and forth," meaning the back and forth with the president, "much ado about nothing?" To which the president responds, "No, Kevin, Jeff Flake is better."
And then my favorite is where Trump says, "I'm hearing that the great people of Utah," capital G, capital P, "are considering their vote for their pompous Senator Mitt Romney to be a big mistake. I agree. He is a fool who's playing right into the hands of the do-nothing Democrats." And then he writes hashtag impeach Mitt Romney.
Yes, exactly.
So first of all,
I shouldn't be impeached, but Mitt Romney should be impeached for criticizing me.
It's not
me.
A thing.
Yes.
You can't impeach a senator.
Yes.
That's been understood for a very long time. And, you know, I mentioned over the weekend, if we hold the president to the standard that he holds other people to, either for treason or for criminal responsibility or for conspiracy— or for impeachment. Just hold everyone to the standard he holds. Just hold him to the standard that he holds for everybody else. He would have been impeached and tried for crimes long ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. Yes. It's like one of the things that like your grandmom would say, he can dish it out, but he can't take it.
my grandmother never would have said that.
She wouldn't have?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not really.
You have any good proverbs?
I don't.
Anything?
I don't today.
Speaking about China, Preet, we should talk about a couple of other things that came out about the president during the past week. And again, there's so much. There's reporting from the president in an interview with Fox Business in April of 2017 saying he informed the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, about airstrikes that he had authorized in Syria while they were dining together at his Oceanside Club. Quote, this is the president of the United States. I was sitting at the table. We had finished dinner. We're now having dessert. And we had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen. And President Xi was enjoying it, Trump said, before telling interviewer Maria Bartiromo that Trump said before he told the interviewer, the Fox News interviewer, that he was told that the airstrikes on Syria were ready to go. Trump then adds that he told Xi that the United States had, quote, just fired 59 missiles heading to Iraq, which is not the country they were actually heading to. They were heading to Syria.
But well, he was confused by the cake.
He was confused by the cake. And then President Trump comes back on Xi and says, and he was eating his cake and he was silent. We were almost finished. It was a full day in Palm Beach. We're almost finished. And I, what does he do? Finishes his dessert and goes home. The chocolate cake.
I kind of want some chocolate cake.
How did that even come back this past week? That the chocolate cake, I guess because we've been talking so much about China.
I guess.
Do you think that the president of China could be bribed with a piece of chocolate cake?
I don't think so.
Was it a quid pro quo?
I don't think so.
So here's the other revelation that came out during the past week, again, after the president was going around calling on all world leaders to investigate his political opponents. It came out that the president, and this doesn't relate to that, but it's still a moment worth pausing on, that he was pestering the Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, for help in recommending Trump for a Nobel Prize during a call. Now, Preet, why would you ask the Japanese Prime Minister like for a Nobel Prize recommendation? I don't know.
You should have given him some cake.
You should have given him some cake.
If I give you this piece of chocolate cake
from Mar-a-Lago, will you?
I can't believe that the Nobel Prize is being conditioned on chocolate cake. Maybe there's some texts about this. All right, so look.
Heroes and villains, Preet.
I imagine that there will be more revelations in the coming week, and some of these folks may testify, and maybe we'll hear about other countries that are swept into all of this. But until next week, Anne.
Please send us your questions, and we'll try our best to answer them.
Thanks, Anne.
Take care.
This is the Cafe Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Aaron Dalton. And the Cafe team is Carla Pierini, Julia Doyle, Calvin Lord, David Kurlander, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.